What I'm going to be talking about is about the point at which Ken leaves off with his speech. He's talking about the mechanical interface, for the most part, of the cylinder restoration process. And after you get that right, then we talk about signal processing. You can use analog, you can use digital. In 1971, Dr. Thomas Stockham presented a paper on the invention of a statistical deconvolution method based on homomorphic filtering. Now, everyone knows what that means, right? Of course you do, right? Basically, this translates loosely as the terminology used to describe the digital filtering employed to eliminate resonances and non-linearity of the old mechanical recording devices. Its eventual application was the restoration of the Caruso's recordings of the last 15 years or so. Now, whether or not you agree or disagree that these digitally restored Caruso's sound better or worse than their analog versions, one must acknowledge the tremendous groundwork laid in the area of digital restoration and signal processing. About the same time that Tom Stockham was doing this work, there was a fellow in California by the name of Dr. James Paul, who was developing similar technologies at Rockwell for the space program, and he was also dealing with deconvolution of the analog waveform. Deconvolution, in this sense, is what Ken was referring to as putting a signal in, putting noise in, being able to extract spectral subtraction, taking away the noise by knowing its input variability, and restoring linearity of the signal at the same time. Now, Dr. Paul's work eventually found its way into NASA, the FBI, the CIA, the NSA, and organizations like this. Tom Stockham went with SoundStream and made musical recordings, and Jim Paul went with this other methodology or this other path and worked on the Nixon tapes, you know, as well as others. The Stockham-style digital filtering utilizes what I generally refer to as the big box method. And this is what Bill and Ken are doing at Syracuse, if I may characterize it as such. They've bought what is essentially these days a large mini computer, a VAX system, which is capable of doing the things that a large mainframe was doing in 1970 and between 70 and 75 or so. And so this is what they're doing is utilizing a mini mainframe to do the processing, hold the work in storage, and process as needed in steps. I believe that's what you're planning on doing if you're not doing it already. This work can take place in real time or it can or not, depending on the application that exists. And in the big box system, it lends itself to the research environment where you're not under a production schedule. You don't have to produce so many digitally restored tapes a week or a month or a year. So the Dr. Paul style utilizes standalone boxes, which are not, they're computers, but they're not big mainframe mini computers. His system utilizes standalone computer processors, each one having a specific function or functions that can be run in real time. Hence, production is increased, and this is what I refer to as the small box methodology of digital processing. A yet other alternative is to buy a board that's made by many companies and stick it into an IBM, AT, or a 386 computer, and digitize and use software such as was the ILS software referred to by Ken a little earlier. And all of these methodologies are viable for various applications. If you're doing cylinders, your frequency bandwidth is limited, so it allows you to use smaller storage requirements, smaller computers, less fast computers. If you want to try to store 6 hours of stereophonic sound in digital bandwidth, 96 dB and 20 to 20 kilohertz, it requires massive amounts of memory to do this properly. What I'm doing at Rodgers and Hammerstein is basically small box restoration. In the last few years, the expense of doing this has dramatically decreased. One of the few things that have gone down is if you have a PC at home or if you bought a computer lately, you know that you can buy an IBM PC now fully equipped for $400, whereas 3 or 4 years ago that was not the case. And it's the same thing in computers. What you're buying, even in the big box methodology, what you bought 5-6 years ago for an extravagant amount of money, you can get double the speed, double the storage capability, and double the software capabilities for the same amount of bucks. So in processing, we use several types of filters. When you do analog restoration, like was done with the Mapleson cylinders, for example, you use many fixed filters. Analog filters are much different than digital filters. Whereas with an analog filter, you're limited by the design of the filter itself. Let's say if you have a rumble on a cylinder at 20 hertz or 30 hertz that was imposed by the mechanical machine, if you take a filter, you're only going to be able to get so narrow on an analog filter. With a digital filter, you can get within 28 hertz filter to filter. So you could just take out exactly what the rumble or the click or the noise or whatever extraneous artifact that may be there, whereas with analog filters you may not be able to do so easily without taking some of the music along with it. The filters that I use primarily with cylinders especially is one that Dr. Paul makes called a 320, and what it is, it's a filter that sort of replaces analog filtering, but it does it much more efficiently. It does it digitally and it does it in real time. I can, on my patch bay, I can punch into the filter from the record player, from the cylinder machine, go through the filter and come out the other end right onto an analog tape or an F1 digital recording. The types of filters you use primarily with digital filtering are notch high pass and low pass, band pass, if you just want to take out a band. Now remember, if you have a troublesome band with a digital filter, you can resolve to a very tight resolution, like I said before, between 23 and 28 hertz. That's extremely narrow. This thing that they were going to put into the RDAT machines, they were going to take off 200 hertz between, 37 and 3900 hertz. Are you familiar with that?
Why do you say it'd be past tense?
Well, because I won't get into it, but in New York City you can buy a box without the chip, okay, for about $1,000. All right. The other filter, I had transparencies, but they don't show up very well up here, so I'm not going to show them, but it's a PDF 2048 that is run by a computer, and what it is, it's an attenuator, which has 512 bands. If you have a graphic equalizer at home, think about it as having 512 bands with the resolution of a 23 hertz between each band, depending on the frequency. And it's completely programmable through an electronic bus that goes from the computer to the device. It's an attenuator and only takes things down. In sound restoration, I never, and I don't think very many other people do either, push things up. You never use a parametric equalizer or a boost equalizer to push things up, especially on acoustical recording. That's really adding insult to injury. So these two filters are used primarily with musical material. Now, a third filter that's in use, digital filter, is an adaptive filter. Now, this is a smart filter. An adaptive filter is a smart filter which looks at the signal coming in and decides more or less what is the wheat and what is the chaff, depending on how you program it. On spoken word, it cancels artifacts such as rumble, background noise, reverberation. It's tunable and it's time correlated. This is called a DAC, Digital Audio Corporation 150, because it's a 150th order filter. Now what that means is your typical filter that you buy in a store, a Urey Little Dipper or an Orban Parametric, is an eighth order filter normally. And we're talking about a 150th order filter to take out things and leave the speech alone. This works very well on spoken word material and anything dealing with speech of a non-musical type. So, in summation, digital filtering is a great asset for many applications in archival restoration, but it's not the only asset. So I'm not here to say that digital filtering is the be-all and end-all to signal processing, because there are many applications when you don't have to use a digital filter. You don't use it just because it's there or just because it's digital. You use it because you need it for the application which you're involved with. the expense of the big box strategy, what about $300,000? Is that a safe, excuse me, $500,000? That's the big box strategy to do it right. And what Ken described with the computer that they have is certainly doing it right. If you don't have $500,000 laying around, then you might want to investigate standalone or independent box strategy depending on your application. I believe this small box strategy is viable for a high production, extensive public service oriented archive like Rodgers and Hammerstein. We're running four studios, each producing a certain amount of tapes for various projects, the Metropolitan Opera, and all sorts of other various projects. And we have about 6,000 to 7,000 requests a year for public service. So we're busy. And we don't get to put as much time on standalone research projects as we'd like. But using these devices, we're able to push out a lot of work and in pretty good sound. Now, knowing how ours people are, I brought along a little tidbit of Leo Tolstoy speaking in English. This is from the Edison National Historic Site. This is digitally processed.
Sorghum, full of every kind of provisions, vegetables and refreshments, are soup, bedding and clothes of every kind in such quantities as to suffice for a great many days. The benefactor then drew up some instruction as to how to make use of the pastry, and of that which...
Let it go, there's another version.
Anybody, as the hostelry had of itself come into existence, and they cast it with great itself. In this same way, the heavy now born, those who do not pay heed to the instruction for the guidance of our life, written in our art, and in all the great teachings of the guidance of mankind, and who live according.
Now that was, doing that analog, it was barely recognizable as anybody. Extensive signal processing was using a low pass filter, taking out some of the resonances, using both adaptive and attenuating filters. So this is a situation where in its analog state, it was not really something that you could listen to, but by having a digital processing, it was able to recover it, to get it to sound the way it sounds now.
When was that made?
1904, I believe. Is that right, Mike?
Yeah.
That's it for me. Any questions? No questions.
No,
there's a question.
Can you say this is less expensive than big box system? Can you give some filter prices and give some idea of what other equipment has to go with it to give a realistic price per unit?
Okay, the boxes themselves run about $7,000 or $8,000, depending on what options you buy. You can buy now an IBM clone 386 to run the ILS software, which Ken and Bill referred to. That's about $5,000 or $6,000. We had a little grant, and we spent about $40,000 to put this stuff together. So I'm quite happy with it, and we're looking. It would be nice to be able to do the big box and do research as well, but we'd have to use the big box for other things besides just signal processing, and then that involves catalogers and all that. So.
Oh, no idea.
We have another question in the back. There was another question back there earlier.
I wanted to ask one question. How many people in the audience have ever made a digital recording?
Not bad.
What did we say, three or four?
Three or four. We got
Thank you very much.